Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Just think, we're getting, if you're in our hemisphere, closer to spring. If you're in the other parts of the world, you're getting closer to fall.
Yeah, it's funny. We're looking out the window of the studio right now, and it's absolutely pouring now.
It's pouring, and it's going to freeze.
And worse yet, we're planning to go out to dinner. We better put our galoshes on.
Yep.
Anyway, that's not the reason we're here. Of course, we're here to bring you another program of On the Menu Radio, and we're delighted that you're joining us today. And who do we have, my dear?
Well, a very, very excellent chef and somebody I love talking to is a New Orleans born, but based in Arlington, Virginia and Washington, D.C., David Guas, who has so many aspects. I don't know what's the most interesting part, but we're going to deal with three of them in this interview today.
First of all, we're going to talk about his Cuban heritage and what that might mean for him in the future, what it means to him mentally already.
His trip with his father.
Yeah, we missed a wonderful event called Meetopia. David was one of the invited chefs, but we thought it was such an interesting story you'd want to hear about that. And then, of course, we had to talk about his own operations itself in the Washington, D.C. area.
So, not to mention he's the spokesperson now for organic honey.
Yeah.
And it turns out he's been a honey buff or honey maven or whatever you'd like to call it for his whole life.
So a man of many parts, David Guas.
One of my favorite people to talk to is David Guas, chef, a pastry chef, entrepreneur, culinary entrepreneur, and a whole bunch of other things now that we're going to talk about. Welcome, David. I always love talking to you.
Well, thanks for having me, and I appreciate it.
Well, as I told you, we have three distinct things to talk about. If we could possibly get to them. The big thing looming is your father left Cuba, I guess, with the revolution, right?
Yes, that's correct, in 59.
And you went back with him to visit.
We did, yeah.
How do you, you wrote a piece, where is this piece?
Well, Food & Wine magazine did an 8-page spread on our travels back.
Uh-huh.
That was actually written by a very notable writer, Mark Rolansky. And Mark and myself and my father and two photographers traveled back to Havana in 2011. And the article was published in November of 2012 from Food & Wine. So.
Uh-huh. Now, I mean, people can access it probably online.
Yeah, it's out there.
Yeah, but you're going to talk to us a little bit about it. Tell us some of your impressions.
Well, you know, it was obviously a very emotional trip, you know, traveling back. It was my father's first return in 53 years and, of course, my first trip. So we, you know, I took a lot of slow steps and kind of really just sort of allowed him to kind of explore the country with me as his sidekick versus, you know, me having all these plans to do a bunch of different things. Obviously, with working with Food & Wine, we had some culinary, you know, sort of appointments where we met local chefs, one in particular, and I got to cook with him in his own restaurant that, believe it or not, he privately owned.
Usually kind of it's in houses, right?
Yeah, a Paladar, exactly. So this was in his home, but generally those are state controlled.
And, oh, are they?
He is you know, been allowed a lot of room to become, you know, a little bit more of an entrepreneur. He was the dean of the culinary school for quite some time and
really?
A very impressive resume in Cuba and also throughout Spain he used to travel. So just a wonderful guy. And so he took me to the farmers markets and to the, you know, the fruit markets and the meat markets and various other places. We went to an urban sort of garden area in the neighborhood of Miramar, just outside of downtown Havana, which was near kind of the embassies. And it was just a wonderful experience to see sort of their organic growing and sort of how their you know, their sort of rows of planted crops are sort of laid out right there in the middle of the city.
Now, you were there in 2011. The article was produced in 2012. Remarkable things have happened since then, things that you probably never thought would happen, and we never thought would happen either.
And your father wouldn't.
Even though it's about the stupidest embargo you can imagine in your whole life. I mean, I don't know what we were I don't know what we were trying to prove, and I don't know what we're trying to prove now that we can't remove it because the president apparently doesn't have the power to do that.
Sure.
But how are things changing, and how more do you think they're going to change as relations get truly regularized?
You know, it's, you know, obviously a million-dollar question. It's you know, time will tell. I like you said, I mean, we've come leaps and bounds and just in this last year and a half, and obviously there's a height of anticipation and a lot of speculation on what it means when it is lifted, how will it be lifted, will it be in stages, you know, so sort of a relaxed travel have been put into place, you know, a year and a half ago, a couple of years ago. And so with that, you know, I think that that's just the beginning of what's to come. How will it change Cuba? You know, I'm hoping, you know, for the better and, you know, with some more money going into the country and being able to sort of preserve the historic buildings and sort of recondition them and bring certain sections of the older part of Havana sort of restored with great history and sort of focusing on the culture and just celebrating what the country is sort of is and was about without the government.
Yeah, there's a lot of architecture that should be saved. And
yes.
Yeah, it's going to cost a lot of money.
Yes, I can't even imagine what that figure is, but I will say that Raul has made it a point in the last, you know, 5 or 6 years to start to put some money towards some of the reconditioning of some of the buildings and restoration. We got to actually see a lot of scaffolding, believe it or not, in certain sections of Havana Vieja, the older part.
I love how you say Havana. I mean, it's the way it's supposed to be said, but I've never heard anybody use it before.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, that certain section of that more historic area of Havana, they really have started to sort of patch up some buildings and attempt to sort of restore certain churches and things like that. So, you know, as far as the rate of progression and how quickly they're happening, I can't really speak on that. I just know what I saw.
Here are two questions for you, David.
Sure.
When are you going to open Bayou Bakery Cuba?
Right.
And who do you like as a Republican candidate? Which of the Cubans do you like?
Yeah, you know, for the first question, you know, not for quite some time. You know, obviously, if and when everything kind of goes down, you know, you kind of want to, a lot of people want to get in front of that, but I don't have that type of capital to sort of gamble like that. I would have to kind of let things kind of happen and then settle and then see where it is. I will say that, you know, my father and I both have talked about, you know, at least purchasing some property or a flat or, you know, an apartment of some sort.
Can you do that?
Not currently, but I'm just saying, you know, just because we know that, you know, when things are different, that it definitely will be a country that we will frequent. So
me too. I want to be your best friend.
There you go. We'll save some room on the futon for you there.
Okay.
but you know, and as far as the current presidential race, you know, I hesitantly sort of am keeping all my thoughts to myself at the moment. I will say that it's been an interesting race, especially
sure.
with the most recent sort of outcome.
Yeah, with Jeb, huh?
South Carolina and everything else. So we'll see. We'll see how it all goes down. And it is nice to see some Cubans in there. I think it says a lot about our country and where we've how far we've come. So you know, we talk about immigrants, and you know, essentially we are all immigrants. We didn't, you know, our fathers or, you know, and forefathers and everything else, you know, chasing things back as far as we can. You know, this is such a young country, so it's hard to say that anybody is, you know, multi-generation or American, although we all are proud to say we're American. So we all come from somewhere. So it's interesting to kind of see a little bit more of that sort of spoken and a level of pride of where our fathers have come from.
Right.
So.
Now, you grew up in New Orleans.
I did, yeah.
Which, I mean, it has such a strong culinary culture. I guess you were heavily influenced by Creole because you focus a lot on New Orleans style in your cookbook.
Mm-hmm.
Was your mother Cuban as well?
No, my mom was, born in the U.S. and she actually was born in Massachusetts.
Okay.
And then at about 9 months or 10 months, she moved to the South and moved to New Orleans and with her family. And
well, I guess what I'm asking is, were you exposed to Cuban cooking when you were growing up?
Sure. My father, he didn't speak a lot of Spanish in the house growing up just because, that was a different generation. He was proud to be in the U.S. and, got his, college degree and went on to get his veterinary medicine degree. And one was extremely busy and wasn't home as often as some people are, and so therefore not a lot of time with dad to sort of teach languages. And so, nowadays everybody tries to speak so many different languages at their children, to expose them to knowing what we know about how they retain things and also the importance of being bilingual. That was a generation that was a little bit different. And
right.
So we did have the food, though. He made it a point to cook Cuban cuisine. My grandmother, his mother, even though she was a native Louisianian, she, moved back to Cuba after meeting my grandfather, and they got married there, and that's
yeah.
when they had a family there. So that was the connection to Louisiana and New Orleans. My grandfather got his law degree at Tulane, but that was just because he was intrigued by the Napoleonic code of law.
Uh-huh.
He was already a practicing attorney in Havana at the time, so he just decided to come to the U.S. and get his law degree at Tulane. So that's where he met my grandmother.
Absolutely.
So my dad did a great job with bringing the black beans and rice and the pork dishes and mojo and the yuca and vaca frita and picadillo and everything else that he could expose me to. Plus we would take frequent trips to Miami to visit our cousins, and so I was exposed to croquetas and pastelitos and all those wonderful things.
Is there an influence of Cuban cooking in your cooking?
Oh yeah. Well, in the book, in the most recent book, Grill Nation, there is a touch of that.
We talked about that book when it came out. Didn't
yeah, not in the first book, the dessert book. The dessert book was really about growing up in New Orleans and sort of the sweets
right.
that influenced my childhood growing up in that incredible state and city. But definitely some of the other dishes in Grill Nation. One thing about Cuban cuisine and my father's style of cooking growing up was he any excuse to be outside on the grill, that's where he was.
Uh-huh.
He loved to cook outside, so it was definitely something that was always around us, and we were exposed to as kids.
My favorite thing is black beans. I'll eat them on any occasion and in every form.
There you go.
Yeah,
I love them too.
You ought to, since we talked about your first book, you ought to plug your two restaurants.
Sure. I mean, Bayou Bakery, Coffee Bar, and Eatery. Our first location, Arlington, Virginia, we've been open since 2010, November, and then we just recently, 9 months ago, opened up a second location in the Capitol Hill neighborhood in southeast Washington, D.C.
That has to be coming up, because when we lived in D.C., that was really not a very good neighborhood.
Right. Just like every little small neighborhood in D.C., it's from the inner core of Northwest downtown area, it's just expanded outward. And, the smaller neighborhoods that were super sketchy are now, ones that people are seen walking, at 10 o'clock at night with no issues. Granted, it's still the city, but, Capitol Hill is an amazing neighborhood and has been, you know, challenging, but yet also very rewarding to have a new location in that particular neighborhood, because it is a very strong network and a very strong neighborhood.
You know, we were talking a little bit earlier about you're going to be at South Beach Food and Wine Festival, right?
That's correct. Coming up.
And there is a subset of the program called Meatopia. Could you tell us about that?
Well, Mark, the Meatopia was one of those things that was stemmed from years ago, and it is really focused on that the inner carnivore that all of us, or tap into, the meat lovers, if you will.
Yeah, I remember when it started. I can't remember who started it.
It was Josh.
Josh Ozersky.
Korsensky, yeah.
Yeah. Who is no longer with us, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
So obviously this is the first one since his passing, and so that much more special and very honored to be on the list of chefs that are participating. You know, it's you can imagine chefs and dreaming up wonderful sort of presentations of, you know, stuffed heads and various things with sunglasses and maybe painting the hooves of the pigs with fingernail polish. I mean, you can name it, and you'll see it, in Miami this coming weekend. So
we used to do that when we did pig roasts. I mean, I used to make little jewelry for the pigs' heads and stuff.
There you go. It's beyond just stuffing an apple anymore. So
yeah.
I think that, like anything, it's kind of the fanfare and the showboating, and the more the merrier, and it's very welcomed. Michael Simon will actually be hosting and sort of
perfect
being the MC, if you will, of the Meatopia event. And then, of course, we've got live music from Greg Allman from the Allman Brothers are going to be playing right there on the beach. So it's going to be incredible, and it'll be my first South Beach festival, so I'm really
excited. Yeah,
really
we're not going to be there this year, but we've been. It's
great.
Huge. I mean, when we went, it was only 30,000 attendees, and now it's like probably a million, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Now, you got into a lot of other things. You're very active on slow food. You're on the Southern Foodways. Are you on the board or just a member?
I'm just a member of the SFA. Yeah,
and what are some of the other things? But you're also, you've popped up as the spokesperson for a Cuban product.
The National Honey Board I do some work with, and it's a wonderful sort of partnership. Honey is something that kind of stemmed, believe it or not, from, very early age for me, but my general curiosity and interest in, beyond the jar was pretty obvious probably about 10 years ago, maybe a little longer, where we used to take trips. I ride a motorcycle, and we have a group of chefs.
You're a Harley guy, aren't you?
I'm a Harley guy, exactly. Yeah. So we would take trips to the Shenandoah and the Blue Ridge Mountains, leaving D.C., and we had a group of chefs that used to ride and still do. And I would collect, jams and jellies and honey on all of our little excursions wherever we went. And so I kind of didn't really have a nickname, but, I was kind of known within our group being a collector. And so at the end of a 2 or 3 day trip, or maybe even an 8 hour trip, I'd fill someone else's saddlebags with tons of things because my bike didn't have saddlebags, so I had to rely on my buddies to sort of carry my load. That's kind of how it started. And, the more people knew how much I loved honey and the different varietals, I started to get gifts, annually through other people's travels. So I'm probably sitting on about 40 or 45 different varietals personally at the house. And then, of course, we use various types of varietals of honey from different sources, all local at both locations of the restaurant. So making salad dressings and marinades and brines.
I'm surprised that you haven't started your own hives, because every place we go now, they're putting in hives on the roof.
Oh, I know. If I didn't work 75 hours a weekend, I would have done it a long time ago. But I also know what it takes to own and manage hives and attend to what a lot of beekeepers call the girls, the ladies. Mm-hmm. I know that you know, they're very self-sufficient, but they're also, you know, like anything, they need to be checked on and maintained. And
yeah, well, in London, they hire a particular company, this woman who's one of these bee whisperer types.
Sure.
And she handles multiple hotels and office buildings and so forth.
Wow. Yeah, that's quite the job. But that's what it would take. You know, you'd have to have somebody that knew a little bit more than you do about sort of tending them. And, you know, I've participated with a lot of the beekeepers that we buy from to help them harvest, also to help them get ready to winterize their hives and get ready for the colder months in this region in the east. And so, you know, I definitely know a lot more about the process than others do, and without sort of owning my own hives, if you will. So,
but you're telling me that you were telling me that honey is going to be the fourth most important export from Cuba.
Yeah, currently it's become the fourth most valuable at the time. So, you know, and again, you know, it's right off the bat, it's very attractive because, one, it's something we can't get yet, so we all want something we can't have, right?
I guess.
And then it's organic, so, you know, a couple of checks in the right box there in the column, and so, you know, the rest is up to our wonderful government to figure things out and, you know, to make sure that we're safe and everything else. And then, you know, who knows, we could be seeing some Cuban honey here in the U.S. shortly.
Well, you certainly have a lot of information, and it's fun talking to you, and I don't know how you fit it all into your life.
Well, you have to welcome it all. You have to not be, you know, draw the boundaries. And, you know, my life is my industry, and my industry is my life. And, you know, my family's in it just like I am. And so there's not a lot of, you know, division. So when you love it, you have to just, you know, do it and live it and be involved in the business and in as many aspects as you can. And you know, remember that you've got, you know, a group of staff that are watching you and hoping that you can lead them to, you know, continue to have, you know, jobs and stability and things like that. So, yeah, I mean, I have a lot on my shoulders, but, you know, so does everybody else. And, you know, I still love what I do. And on a daily basis, I'd rather be in my restaurants than anywhere else.
Now, so you believe in the Mario Batali theory that sleep is overrated.
That's right. Well, I don't, you know, I try to sneak in at least 6 hours. So it's, you know, and 7 is like, you know, just a gift, if you will, or feels like I'm on vacation. So, you know, you'd like anything, you take what you can get when you get it. You know, when it's in front of you and it presents itself, then you sort of take advantage of it. So,
well, it's been a pleasure to talk to you again, David, and we wish you continued success and a great deal of honey business in the future.
There you go. I really appreciate you having me on, and it was great talking with y'all again.
Oh, yeah, I love it. Thank you.
You bet.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We should be starting in maple syrup, sugar tapping, or sugaring as they call it, about this time of the year. Although with this really quirky weather, the trees started, the sap started running early, and now it's going to freeze and snow. So who knows? The one thing I'm certain of is that those little plastic bottles shaped like honey bears you get in the supermarket ain't maple syrup. In fact, it has no maple syrup in it at all.
So in honor of Maple Syrup Month, our next guest is called?
Yes, this is Winton Pitcoff, who actually edits the trade publication, a trade publication for maple syrup. And we asked him to talk to us about the ins and outs of production and product. Winton Pitcoff is the editor of the Maple Syrup Digest, which I actually didn't know even existed. Welcome, Winton, and I'm glad to know that somebody is looking after our North American and Canadian maple syrup issues.
Thank you, Anne. It's nice to be with you.
Okay. Now, is maple syrup really quintessentially American, Canadian?
Yes, it absolutely is, and that's due to the fact that this is where maple trees grow. Based on the climate and the soils and the terrain, this is the part of the world that's most hospitable to sugar maple trees. And so the earliest records about extracting sap out of maple syrup, out of maple trees, is from the 1700s, something that the colonists learned from the Native Americans.
Oh, wow.
I was going to ask you about that. So the tradition goes back to the Native Americans, and the new Americans learned from them.
Absolutely. That's where we got the idea.
Now, it's timely for us to discuss this, since March is maple syrup month. Now, is that because the product itself is seasonal to March?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. The way the sap flows in the trees, the sap flows best when the nights are very cold and the days are warming up above freezing. And so that's when you can drill taps in the trees and collect the sap and boil it down to make syrup. The rest of the year there is some sap flow, but not as much as this time of year. And the later it gets in the season, the sap develops some off flavors that you wouldn't make very good syrup out of.
Really?
Now, it sounds a little bit unfair. I mean, you're sort of drilling the holes
in the poor trees.
I mean, do they feel anything? is it generally okay?
This is one of the most sustainable crops there is, along with fruit and other tree crops. It's not like vegetables where plants are annuals. Maple trees are perennials, and there are trees that have been tapped for 100 years or more. As the industry has grown and as science has helped us understand how the trees work, we've definitely developed practices, tapping guidelines, so that we know how to safely extract sap from trees and make sure that it's a sustainable practice, so that the trees are still going to be there for us in the future years and future generations.
And it's sophisticated.
Are they called farmers, or are they called tappers? I mean, is there a generic name for them?
Sugar makers.
I mean, I guess it's in the sugar maker's best interest to make sure they really take good care of their trees.
Absolutely. And so that has to do with making sure that you only tap trees that are mature enough to heal, because once you pull the tap out, the trees are amazing. They close up those holes their own and regrow around them. And it also has to do with how many taps you put in each tree. So you don't want to tap a tree that's usually trees that are of a size ready to tap, 25 or 30 years old, and trees that are that size at that age, you would just want to put one tap in, and only when trees get really big, about 3 feet in diameter or more, would it be safe to put more than one tap in.
Now, do you tap trees that you own on your own land, or is it like hunting rights?
Some people own big tracts of land, and they get all their sap from their own property. Some rent trees, essentially, by either paying in syrup or in money to landowners who have trees that they don't tap themselves. There's also more and more states are opening up state-owned land, and certainly in Canada, provincial-owned land, to allow sugar makers to tap trees there.
Oh, okay. So you can actually rent not just a few trees, but a whole piece of ground.
Right.
Yeah, well, this whole process is much more sophisticated than what our ancestors learned from Native Americans, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's still at the core, it's a very, very simple process. You're taking one ingredient, and that's the sap out of the trees, and all you're adding is heat and boiling it down and concentrating the sugars that are in the sap. The sap that comes out of the tree is about anywhere between 1 and 2 or maybe 3% sugar. Maple syrup is 66% sugar. So you're putting that sap in a big pan over a flame, whether it's wood or oil-fired evaporator, and boiling it down until it's the right consistency to be called maple syrup. The technology has certainly changed. The early records, as we were talking about the colonists doing it, the sap was collected in a hollowed out log, and then hot stones were put in. And that was how it was concentrated, because they weren't even using iron at that point to be able to boil it down over a flame. And the technology has definitely changed. Very high efficiency evaporators, a lot of attention paid to how to use the least amount of wood or oil, because that's the biggest expense for a sugar maker.
Now, it's not only tasty, but it's healthful. It's apparently fat-free, allergen-free, lower in calories than most other sweeteners, high in antioxidants, vitamins, minerals, and amino acids. It sounds like it's really good stuff.
It really is.
Yeah.
And, of course, it tastes fantastic. But, yeah, again, as, you know, it's been popular for as long as it has because it's so sweet and delicious and versatile, because it can be used for so many different things. But as science has progressed, we've been able to analyze it and find that it's high in things like manganese and zinc and magnesium, and that of all the various sugars, it's higher in sucrose than other sweeteners, and so it has less of a negative impact on people's blood sugar level.
Now, a lot of this is probably to do with the soil, right? So the soil that forms on top of the underlying geology, which just happens to be there in the northeastern United States and across the border into Canada, is probably the reason all this good stuff is in there. I mean, that's how the manganese gets in there, because originally it was part of the rock which underlies the soil in which the trees grow.
That's right.
Isn't my husband smart?
I was a geographer. I did a little.
Yeah, I know.
I did a little geology. I did a little on the soils of the world and things like that. So I do know just a little bit about it. I did have a terminology question, because you're swapping back and forth between syrup and sugar. Now, is maple syrup and maple sugar actually the same thing? Or is there a maple sugar that's crystallized out like a typical refined sugar?
It's a progression along a chain, essentially. Maple sap, as I said, is if you looked at it, you would think it was water, and it tastes a little bit sweet, but certainly nothing like maple syrup. So you boil it to the proper consistency, and then you have maple syrup.
Okay.
If you continue to boil it, still not adding anything new, you'll reach a point where you can make what's called maple cream out of it. And so you've boiled it about 17 degrees hotter than it is when it's maple syrup. And then you whip it, and you have a wonderful spreadable cream that tastes just like maple syrup.
That sounds good.
If you boil it even farther, it becomes, it's still a liquid while it's boiling, obviously, but you pour it out into molds, and you can make maple candy. And again, it's pure, nothing but maple sap as far as the ingredients go. And essentially, each of these steps along the way, you're just removing more and more of the water and leaving behind the solids and the sugars. And so the final step after that actually is you can make a granulated maple sugar. Yeah. And in fact, in the 1800s, maple sugar was the way was what most sap was boiled down into. At that time, sugar cane and beet sugar was not as common, was not as popular. It was called slave sugar in the United States because it came from the islands. And so maple sugar was the primary sweetener. But because maple syrup isn't as shelf stable, you can't keep it around for quite as long, the producers then were making it into maple sugar. And so the corner store or the general store in your town would have a giant barrel full of sugar, and you'd go in and you'd buy a pound of it, and they'd scrape it out and put it in a bag or a box for you, and that was how you would buy your maple. You could reconstitute it by adding a little bit of water and getting it back to the point of what we know as maple syrup. But the primary crop then was maple sugar.
Now, you're at least part of the time, you probably do other things as well, you're occupied with essentially defending the cause of maple syrup and the sugar makers. Tell us a little bit about who you're defending it against, because it's really sort of a bit of a scandal.
Yeah, well, it's been in the news lately. There are all kinds of people promoting maple syrup, or it's not, or it's adulterated.
Right. One of the things that's fascinating about the sort of culture of maple syrup is that it is a very regional product. That certainly you travel outside the United States and it's almost unheard of. Those of us that produce it that live in the Northeast and the U.S. and Canada, it's very common. But once you travel outside of the maple producing areas, it's less of a common product. So those of us up here sort of forget that there are other things that people put on their pancakes and waffles in other parts of the country. But there are what's commonly termed table syrups, and these are things that you tend to find in plastic bottles in your grocery store.
Yeah, which most people think as maple syrup, yeah.
Right, and they're brown like maple syrup. syrup and they flow like maple syrup, but they don't taste like maple syrup. They tend to be corn syrup with some artificial or maybe natural flavorings added to them. But they tend to not have any pure maple syrup in them at all.
Wow. And who's the watchdog for that?
Well, it's basically on the industry to keep tabs on it. There was a letter written in the last couple of weeks that I think you've seen or have seen news reports about it, asking the FDA enforce truth in labeling laws. And it's pretty clear in the law that if it says maple on it, it's supposed to actually have maple in it. And there are plenty of products out there that say maple that if you look closely, there's no real maple syrup in it. So it's part of an educational campaign. I mean, really, it's up to the consumers to understand. And it's an ongoing struggle because the stuff that isn't real maple syrup doesn't really taste very good. And if that's people's first impression of what they think maple is, they're not likely to then try to seek out real maple syrup.
It's also not very healthy either, right? So it doesn't have all these health benefits. So when you're eating your cereal, which supposedly is infused with maple, and you think
it's not.
You think you're feeding something good to your children when in fact it's totally fake.
Exactly. No, it's not good for you at all.
Now, pure maple syrup tends to be pricey, though, by standards of people who are used to buying those little plastic things in the supermarket.
I would phrase that differently. I don't think maple syrup tends to be expensive. I think the other stuff tends to be artificially
cheap.
There's all kinds of arguments around that, about how corn is grown and subsidized in the United States, but made from inexpensive, cheap ingredients. Maple syrup, as far as I'm concerned, isn't priced high enough for what it takes to actually produce it.
Right. Now, people who are interested in the process, they can actually visit these sugar houses, and there is a resource for finding out which ones are available. What is that? It's a website.
That's right. We've launched a website called maplemonth.org. Most of the maple-producing states in the U.S. and the producing provinces in Canada have trade associations for all the sugar makers in their regions. And most of those associations have events each year, whether it's the ceremonial tapping of the first tree, which we do here in Massachusetts in about a week, or pancake breakfasts at sugar houses, or tours and open houses at sugar houses where you can go and see maple syrup being made or see how the trees are tapped and how the sap comes out. And so this website, maplemonth.org, it provides links to all of the states and provinces and all of the events that they're having. And there are hundreds and hundreds of sugar makers who have their sugar houses open to the public this time of year. And people who visit will see maple syrup being made and will get to taste the products and hopefully buy some to bring home.
Now, here's the bottom line question, I guess. Is the industry growing? Is the output growing, or is it shrinking, or is it just sort of hanging on there?
The industry is absolutely growing, and as people have gotten more and more interested in healthy foods, in natural foods, in local foods, it's definitely growing. It has a long way to go. We have a very, very small part of the sweetener market in the globally as well as in the United States, particularly when you look at where it was again back in the 1800s when it was the dominant sweetener. But as I said, as more people are becoming aware of it, and as we're doing more of this kind of outreach like the Maple Month website, people are understanding what maple syrup is, and once you try it, you tend to stick with it.
Now, how can you, if you're going to the supermarket, let's suppose I'm going to a Whole Foods market today, and I think, oh boy, I'd really like to have some maple syrup to put on pancakes for tomorrow. How can you be sure you're getting the right thing? Are the brand names? Is there a store directory that says, you know, this store has real maple syrup?
You just want to look for something that says pure maple syrup.
Okay.
That's something that, you know, none of the imitation ones will make that claim. There are very distinctive style jugs that you'll find maple syrup in. As long as you look at it and it says 100% pure maple syrup, and you look at the ingredients list, and it shouldn't say anything other than maple syrup.
Yeah. Now, how did you get involved with this?
I live in an area where maple syrup is produced, and it's a really wonderful way to get out of winter a little early, you know, be outside and working in the woods when most people are still holed up inside because it's still snowy and icy and still cold. But that's when we're getting ready and getting ready for that first thaw to get the first sap.
Well, we've enjoyed talking to you very much. We've learned a lot today.
Yes.
Listeners, I'm sure you enjoyed that very much too, and you'll look out for pure maple syrup in the future. And in the meantime, we hope you have a great maple syrup month, and we'll talk to you again at some point, I feel sure. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And sweetheart, what are we doing to close out today's program?
Well, you know, every time you turn around, there's some new invention having to do with coffee, also some new invention having to do with flour, some new creation. And now we have a chief research professor from Brandeis University who holds over 100 patents, many of them having to do with food, with his latest product, which is actually coffee bean flour. You know, I'm not sure what's more interesting, the product that we engaged you to talk to us about, Daniel Perlman, but you yourself, your background's fascinating. You are a senior research, what, at Brandeis University?
Senior research scientist at Brandeis University. I've been working here for about 35 years.
And you have like 100 patents, and most of it's food-related?
Many of them are food-related, and quite a number are also related to devices used in research laboratories and hospitals.
Uh-huh. Now, this current product is it's setting out to create an enormous stir and a lot of global interest, as I understand it, and it's flour made from coffee beans. Is that correct?
Yes, it is, but it's not the traditional coffee bean that people buy in the store, which is dark brown to black. The way we prepare the coffee bean, it comes out more or less golden color.
Yeah, now, it's par-baked.
That is correct.
Now, what was the goal? What drove you to make this product?
Well, several years back, I became intrigued with the antioxidants found in the green coffee bean. Green coffee bean extract is sold worldwide as a dietary supplement at considerable cost, and I knew that the green coffee bean contains a high level of antioxidant, and I began to do some reading and discovered that conventional roasting of the coffee bean destroyed a large portion of that beneficial antioxidant. I was wondering whether one could prepare the bean in such a way to preserve the antioxidant. So that was my primary interest and goal. And I began a series of experiments to see whether we could preserve and rescue the antioxidants inside the bean rather than extract them out of the green coffee bean.
But as I listen to people talk about this product, what is the official title of the product, by the way?
Well, if you want to give an official title, it would be coffee bean flour prepared from par-baked coffee beans.
Okay.
Or flour from the par-baked coffee bean.
But people seem mainly interested in the extra kick of caffeine that comes with it.
Oh, most definitely. As a matter of fact, I became gradually more and more surprised that rather than focusing on the group of antioxidants found in the coffee bean, that people became more interested in this flour as a natural food source for caffeine. Before then, you know, either you could add caffeine as a chemical additive, that's rather unattractive, or you could purchase extracts from tea. So tea and coffee are really the predominant sources in the diet for caffeine. And I just thought that why extract these constituents from the coffee bean if you could mill the entire bean into a fine flour and use the flour in cooking and baking.
Now you've invented this, and I understand that it was even referenced on the Today Show this very morning on the day that we're talking. But what happens now? I mean, what's your modus operandi? You've achieved your research goal. Now what happens?
Well, now we're seeking a major food ingredient company to produce and market this coffee bean flour worldwide so that the world can benefit from not only the caffeine, which is preserved in its entirety in our product, but also the antioxidant, which is, has similarities and differences to natural fruit and vegetable antioxidants found throughout the plant kingdom, the so-called phenolic antioxidants. And coffee bean that we use contains as much as 10% by weight of antioxidant, and this particular antioxidant, known as chlorogenic acid, has been clinically shown to modulate the release of glucose into the bloodstream after after a meal. So it really has potential for being a health benefit when incorporated into food products.
Now you actually get this from conventional coffee, so you're buying coffee beans from all the places where coffee is grown, like in West Africa and Mexico and Colombia and places like that?
Yes, we've actually collaborated with a good-sized coffee roasting company in the Boston area, and they have actually scaled up my process to a commercial scale to par-bake the bean at a reduced baking temperature, and that temperature is approximately 300 degrees Fahrenheit rather than the roasting temperature for a conventional coffee that is around 425 to 450 Fahrenheit. And so we have prepared large amounts of those so-called par-baked coffee beans, and then we use a process to very, very finely mill that into a flour that it consists of small enough particles that are not gritty when eaten.
Yeah, now this a friend of mine owns a bakery, and I couldn't get my head around that either. They use actually used coffee grounds in some of their products or baked goods, and I don't understand why.
Yeah, that's a mystery to me as well, because the leftover coffee grounds would be depleted.
Yes.
Both in caffeine and in the chlorogenic acid antioxidants.
And gritty, too. It'd be gritty.
Yes. No, coffee grounds, notoriously gritty, and that's because the cellulosic material in the coffee bean is very tough and robust. So it's very important to grind the material finely enough. And again, our product is not dark at all, like the traditional roasted coffee bean.
I got that small amount you sent me. It's sort of ochre colored or beige, right?
Yes.
And it is very fine.
Right.
Don't even have to use it in a baked good or cooked product. You could just mix it and make a paste out of it, or put it in a smoothie as is.
Exactly. We have made smoothies with it. And, of course, the bakery applications are probably most interesting, but any type of food product, including even nut butters, hummus, and hummus spreads, anything that is paste-like is a natural vehicle or carrier for this, but you're absolutely correct. You can combine this into smoothies as well.
Now your intent, you're sort of sitting back now waiting for the Ralph Waldo Emerson effect to take place. You're expecting that people are going to beat a pathway to your door in the Boston area? Is that
That would be very nice. But our university, Brandeis University in the Boston area, does have a technology transfer office, and they're quite successful at finding partners to produce and sell products that come out of our technology at the university. So we're hopeful that between the university's efforts and the publicity that you folks bring to it, we will have considerable commercial interest in this. And again, both for the caffeine as well as for the beneficial antioxidant that this product contains.
Aren't you worried a little bit about the misuse of this product? You know, like those beverages that kills the people that kids have been using to disastrous results, like Jolt or whatever those things are?
Not really, because if you were to put so much of this into a food product, it would taste rather bitter and disagreeable. So we're really putting in, if you put in, for example, more than 10% of a recipe of this, the flavor becomes noticeable. So we really, it's rather bland if you put it in at 5% or possibly as much as 10%. So at that level, you're not going to be getting more than a cup or two of coffee's worth of caffeine.
And you're not at all concerned about flavor here. It's mainly the benefits of the antioxidants and the caffeine.
Right, right. We're really not producing this to alter flavor. As a matter of fact, it's rather light and nutty in flavor. We see that as a plus. We want this to be as versatile as possible, and so that's why we don't bake it to a level where we're going to generate coffee flavor, because then anything that you added to would taste like coffee, and the product would become darkened. So this is rather a very benign product. And, again, at the usage levels that we're talking about, so at, say, for example, 5 grams of this in a 50 to 75-gram serving of some food, you'll be getting more or less the level of caffeine that you'd find in a cup of coffee.
What do you envision your largest market segment to be?
Well, at present, I see it probably the bakery segment. I, for example, have prepared blueberry muffins, conventional breads, and what's very nice about this coffee bean flour is that it is perfectly compatible with the rising of both batters and doughs. So if we have compared the yeast rise in conventional breads, and we see no difference between with or without the flour, coffee bean flour being added. So,
how does it go with weed? That's the other thing. Everybody's making these weed brownies. Did you know that?
Yeah. Well, actually, I've made brownies with this, and it's just really, really fine. And keep in mind that the coffee bean is gluten-free for those folks out there that want to stay away from gluten.
Yeah, but I mean, how does it mix with marijuana? Because that's the hot new product. Everybody's rushing to capitalize on the marijuana market when it's legalized.
Yeah, well, I suppose this will keep the marijuana aficionado from falling asleep, right?
and they'll get something healthy in the process.
That's right. This has no attenuating effect on the mad munchies, I've been told.
Good.
Listen, we need to do one more thing for sure before we forget. How do people who have an interest in commercializing this
coffee bean flour. How do they get in touch with you so that they can bring you disgusting amounts of money in return for your magic invention?
Yes, well, they can find me by visiting the Brandeis University website, and they'll find me as Daniel Perlman, that's P-E-R-L-M-A-N, and not to be confused with a second Dan Perlman who works at Brandeis, but his first name is Dan, and I'm the Daniel Perlman. The other one is a provost for learning at the university, so they can find me at the university website or call me directly at the university if they prefer. I don't know whether they can reach me by email, which is, I can give that to you if you wish.
Please, go ahead.
That's dperlman@brandeis.edu, and that's spelled dperlman@brandeis, spelled brandeis.edu.
Right. Well, you have such a history of food-related, especially, and equipment-related inventions. Are you already on the next one?
Oh, yes. Oh, most definitely. We're working on a new dietary fiber that is very, very well tolerated, and we're very excited about that research. We've done a considerable amount of feeding experiments with animals, and now we're beginning to use that with humans. That's on the dietary fiber side, and
I hope it's not with Parmesan cheese and sawdust.
No. Remarkably, it's based on an all natural vegetable product, and I guess I'm not supposed to talk about it yet, but
okay.
Hopefully you'll be hearing more about that in the near future.
Well, keep us posted.
You know what? We ought to get you in touch with Hervé Tisse in Paris.
Oh yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Well, speaking of France, I'm also working hard on developing a wine bottle that has no drip, since we're working on multiple fronts.
Didn't we have one of those, such as Rabbit? No drip.
We had a no drip thing that went in the neck of a wine bottle,
right.
which is not new. There are lots of those on the market.
Yeah.
Yes. No. We're focused on actually the architecture of the glass and.
Yeah.
We've already been through one generation of modified glass architecture to attenuate the drip in the wine bottle.
Well, the gentleman's name I mentioned, Hervé, H-E-R-V-E.
He knows him. T-H-I-S.
Do you know him?
What is the last name?
T-H-I-S, Tisse. He's French.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I don't know him, but I'd be delighted to meet him.
Google him and see.
You'll find him. I think he runs a food institute at a branch of the Sorbonne, I think, or something like that in Paris.
Yes,
and his focus is on feeding the world using chemicals because he thinks like Malthus once again.
Yes, I have heard about that work.
Okay.
I am an advocate of old-fashioned food, which has delightful mouthfeel and flavor.
Me too.
Okay.
Well, I think chemicals have their limits.
Okay. Well, it's been so much fun talking to you, Daniel, and I'm sure that we'll have reason to talk again because I'm sure you're going to come up with something next which will make the Today Show and the Tonight Show and all the other places and, of course, On the Menu Radio. So thank you for your
thanks
time.
So much, and I look forward to that.
Thank you, Daniel.
You're welcome, and be well.
You wonder what Dr. Daniel's going to come up with next, don't you?
Yeah, indeed.
And when we find out, we'll be sure to invite him back and have another chat with him because he's certainly a very interesting fellow. And we know you're very interesting people, too, and you have lots more to do this particular Sunday. So we'll say goodbye until next week, same time, same place.
Bye-bye.